It is Friday, October 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Turkish police look for the remains of a missing Saudi journalist. Parliamentary elections are postponed in Afghanistan's Kandahar province.
People in Afghanistan are very emotional right now.
And pumpkins highlight the fall season at an orchard in Maryland. It's all ahead. Turkish police are looking for the remains of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in a forest near Istanbul and at a rural location about 90 kilometers south of the city. Turkish officials said Friday police are conducting searches for the missing journalist in Belgrade Forest and in the city of Yalova. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the Saudis should be given a few more days to finish and make public a credible investigation before the U.S. decides how or if to respond. International Edition's Lori London asked Robert Dietz, professor at George Mason University and former special counsel of the U.S. National Security Agency, how we can count on a credible result if we're relying on the government accused of committing the atrocity is also doing the investigation.
In my view, and this is just my analysis of what's going on here, is something that's happened in the past where we give a malefactor time, a malefactor who's a national leader, time to find a fall guy, of somebody to take responsibility. And this fall guy will be identified as a rogue, somebody working outside his authority on behalf of the kingdom. And the time Secretary Pompeo is giving them is time for them to cook their story. That's my best guess.
Why would the U.S. be so seemingly complicit that they are working with the Saudis to come up with a story rather than getting to the actual truth of something that seems just so horrific?
I never said they were complicit or working with the Saudis. I suspect that time is being given to Saudis for them to work up the story. And I think the easy answer to that question is that we need Saudi Arabia. Yes, they need us, but we need Saudi Arabia. We need them as a counterweight to Iran. I mean, that's been sort of American doctrine for many, many years, well, ever since the Shah left. If Saudi Arabia is somehow cut off by us, for example, trying to organize boycotts of their oil, we cannot have boycotts of both Iranian and Saudi oil. The other nations in the world are going to say, wait a minute, what do you expect us to do without oil? And so, you know, if we're going to have a boycott of Iranian oil, we cannot boycott Saudi oil. In addition, Saudi Arabia buys enormous quantities of American arms hardware, you know, jets and other kinds of weapons. And so I don't think we can walk away from them for this one thing, even though this one thing is quite horrendous.
You talk about arms, you know, we've heard horrors that U.S.-made weapons are contributing to in places like Yemen, which is seeing one of the worst famines in the world. People are dying, civilians are getting killed by the thousands. We're supposed to be a leader in human rights here.
Yes.
How is our response to just basically give them a free pass? What kind of a statement is that making? Is it giving dictators around the world a license to just do the same?
No, I don't think it is. In an ideal world, of course, there would be repercussions, but this is realpolitik. You can't just ignore Saudi Arabia's position in the Middle East, in an area that is just fraught with all kinds of problems. What we do with Saudi Arabia has got to be looked in the context of trying to keep Iran in the box, trying to deal with Syria, and of course encouraging the flow of oil. It's akin to three-dimensional chess. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to do the following, and that'll solve the problem, because if you do something, it's going to have repercussions elsewhere in the Middle East. And so, and by the way, for all our, you know, idealism and so forth, the U.S., particularly during the bad old days of the Soviet Union, supported and was kind of in bed with a lot of pretty bad characters. And the only defense was, well, they're anti-communist. again, because we need Saudi Arabia, we can't just say the death of this one person, as horrible as it was, is going to be the lever that changes our relationship with Saudi Arabia.
And what about the Crown Prince, and what about all these videos showing these suspects that apparently had very close ties to him? How did they get past that, trying to say that this was a rogue situation that they didn't know about, when you've also got one of the close associates, the forensic expert within the Saudi government, showing up with a bone saw?
Agreed. To my mind, what's going on is akin to a dance, and people understand the steps to the dance. The Saudis will come up with a story that most of us will look at and say that's completely implausible. Our president and other national leaders in Europe will accept it because that's how the dance operates. But nobody deep down is going to say, oh yeah, that sounds like exactly what happened. Moreover, I suspect that in accepting this whatever story is cooked up, the U.S. and other leaders of other nations will have a serious talk with the Crown Prince and possibly the King and say, look, you got a free pass on this one, but you can never, ever do this again. You've got to get the Crown Prince, you've got to keep him in the box.
Robert Dietz of George Mason University. U.S. lawmakers are condemning the Saudis and questioning the seriousness with which Trump and his top aides are taking the matter, while Trump has emphasized the billions of dollars in weapons the Saudis purchased from the United States. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Pakistan criticizes India's purchase of a defense system from Russia. Experts question the World Bank's role in a dam in Laos. President Trump threatens a military shutdown of the Mexican border because of a migrant onslaught. And Democrats surge ahead in fundraising. But will it be enough to topple Republicans in the midterm elections? Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Archaeologists conducting a dig at an ancient Italian cemetery have found the skeletal remains of a 10-year-old child that suggested a so-called vampire burial. The remains included a skull with a rock intentionally placed into the mouth in what was described as a possible religious or superstitious effort to prevent the deceased from rising from the dead. According to the researchers, the cemetery where the remains were found was used to bury babies and young children back in the 5th century. It's thought that the youngsters may have died in an outbreak of malaria that swept the Italian region of Umbria at that time. The archaeologists say that they believe placing the stone into the child's mouth may have been part of a funeral ritual designed to contain the disease as well as the body itself. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, protests take place at a temple in southwest India concerning the admission of women. We'll have a report. A spokesman for Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said parliamentary elections in Kandahar province in southern Afghanistan will be postponed for a week following the killing of influential commander General Abdul Razak. Elections across the rest of the country are scheduled to proceed on Saturday, October 20th. A Taliban statement claiming responsibility said the attack Thursday that killed Razak was aimed at him and General Scott Miller, the commander of the United States and NATO forces in Afghanistan. The U.S. commander, who was unharmed in the attack, refuted that claim. Miller was in Kandahar for high-level meetings with provincial officials on the upcoming elections. VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim in Kabul tells me about the postponement of elections in Kandahar.
We heard this announcement this morning. It's been confirmed now by multiple official sources, including the Election Commission and the Presidential Office. The election will be held next Saturday. So the election in the rest of the country is this Saturday. the 20th of October. But in Kandahar, it's been postponed for a week, especially because General Rafiq was not just a police commander. He was a larger-than-life personality who was highly politically influential. Some people would argue that he was one of the most influential and richest men of southern Afghanistan, and also because he was famous as the man who kept Taliban at bay. Kandahar was more peaceful than many Afghan provinces. In the rest of the country, the Taliban have had more influence and were gaining ground, whereas in Kandahar, they seemed to be losing ground. And this was not the first attack on General Rafiq's life. The Taliban had tried scores of times. Some people quote as many as 19 or 20 times, but whatever the number, it was a very high number of attacks that General Rafiq had on his life. And finally, it seems like the Taliban have succeeded.
Well, now this delay apparently gives an opportunity to prepare or to observe the funeral rites. But I'm sure in addition, it gives authorities some more time to perhaps strengthen security.
Perhaps it does, because tomorrow and during elections, the government has planned to deploy around 50,000 security personnel, which sounds like a very high number. But when you look at the number of polling stations in the country, about 5,100 polling stations that will be open, the number is not that high. It only comes down to like maybe 9 or 10 people per polling station. So maybe by having the Kandahar election separate, the government can provide it more security and more comprehensive security. But more importantly, people in Afghanistan are very emotional right now. They regarded General Rafiq as a hero in southern Afghanistan particularly, who saved them from the Taliban. Now, while I'm saying all this, we have to also remember that there were accusations of serious human rights abuses against him, including from international human rights groups. So he had this split personality. Some people, he was able to keep Taliban at bay because he was so brutal in his treatment with Taliban and their supporters. But yes, this delay in a week will give the government time to prepare and provide extra security, but will also give people the time to emotionally and mentally absorb the blow, and it is a serious blow for southern Afghanistan, and to then move on with their lives.
Well, meanwhile, in the rest of Afghanistan, how are preparations continuing for the election Saturday?
So the rest of Afghanistan is ready for elections. The voting will start very early in the morning, 7 a.m., and it will go on till 4 p.m. However, the people who are already in the polling station by 4 will get a chance to vote even after 4. All the election material has been distributed. We saw General Scott Miller, the top U.S. and NATO commander in Afghanistan, out on the streets in Kabul, shaking hands with the Afghan security forces and checking on their election readiness. I think it was also an attempt by the general to show not only that he was unharmed and in good health, because the attack, the Taliban claimed, was on General Rafiq and General Miller, but he also wanted to show to the Afghans that the international security forces were here and, you know, were ready to support the Afghan government if needed. Now, the Afghan Election Commission and all the other Afghan security forces are already, the campaign ended yesterday, officially ended, and now everybody's just waiting to see how many people turn out to vote. 9 million Afghans have registered to vote out of a population of a little over 33 million. However, there are allegations that not all 9 million are genuine votes. Some people have registered with fake ID cards, etc. The concerns are that Afghanistan is introducing a new biometric system that has not been tested before, and everybody's keeping their fingers crossed that the biometric system works. And the two big concerns are the biometric system, and the second one, of course, is security, because this has been a bloody election campaign. 10 candidates have already been killed in various attacks since the start of the nomination period. The Taliban have announced that they will do whatever it takes to derail the process. They've already sent a note out to teachers and principals and directors of schools to not let their schools turn into polling stations. The plan is that many schools will become polling stations. And the Taliban have told teachers and principals to not participate in the process, and they have promised attacks against the election process. So security will be the biggest concern, and then the technical concerns about the biometric system, etc.
VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim reporting from Kabul, Afghanistan. Despite a ruling last month from the Indian Supreme Court targeting a centuries-old tradition, Hindu groups have prevented women of reproductive age from entering the Sabarimala temple in southwest Kerala state, prompting authorities to issue an emergency. On Friday, Hindu priests joined protesters to prevent these women from entering the site. In its recent ruling, India's Supreme Court said equality is irrespective of age and gender. The controversy comes amid a national debate over the rights of women in India. The country's junior foreign minister, J.J. Akbar, resigned to fight allegations of sexual harassment of women while a journalist. Rafiq Dosani is a senior economist and director of Asia-Pacific policy at the RAND Corporation. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the High Court has sought to upend generations of religious practice.
Even older women, there were some liberalizations. So it was primarily the restrictions applied to women who were so-called between the ages of 10 and 50.
Why has this long-standing ban been in force?
For that, one has to go to the history of the temple, that it was a temple that is for the worship of a particular lord, you know. And according to the traditions of that worship in the sanctum sanctorum, which is around the icon, women have never been allowed, you know, or at least so it is believed.
Why did the Supreme Court rule the way it did?
So the Supreme Court responded to activists saying that this is not fair. And obviously in today's day and time, you know, it isn't fair that women should be treated as excluded citizens. But then, you know, it's very hard. There are people, apparently within the protesters, there are even women saying that women should not be allowed.
These groups, these conservative Hindu groups, are defying the Supreme Court. What will happen next, do you think?
The law lays the onus on the state government to make sure that the Supreme Court's laws are fulfilled. And so state government is kind of helpless right now, because politically, if it goes in there, if somebody dies in the protests against allowing women, there'll be a huge political price to pay.
There's already been violence at the site. Can negotiation possibly work?
I don't expect women to be allowed in this round of the festival. This is something that will only get resolved through negotiation over the next year. I think this one is gone, because the government is not going to go in and force people out so easily. You know, it's too sensitive politically. So here you have a leftist government, a communist government in Kerala, which is sworn to live by the secular rule book. And now it's stuck facing a situation where it can't do anything. It's very politically nice for the national government to say, look, communist government can't fulfill the law.
And of course, you've had all these reported rapes that have been going on. Is culture changing slowly in India, in your view?
Yes, I think it is. It's been well known for many, many years that, you know, women had very little power when men made sexual advances. But beginning a few years ago, there started to be cases filed on powerful men. You know, a journalist from the famous magazine Tehelka was imprisoned, and he's still in prison for what he did to a woman reporter. And now you have this going on. So I think it's a very encouraging sign that, and very courageous of the women concerned, given how backward India is in terms of social mores.
Rafiq Dosani of the RAND Corporation, he said it's remarkable the number of Indian women who are going public with accusations of improper sexual behavior. He believes this underscores the many more women who've suffered the same fate but refuse to come forward. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. During the fall season in the United States, pumpkin festivals are popular. They typically feature fun activities like wandering through a corn maze, going on a hayride, and picking a pumpkin off the vine. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to Butler's Orchard, a family-owned farm outside Washington where people search for the perfect pumpkin.
The pumpkin theme is everywhere at Butler's Orchard in Germantown, Maryland. It has thousands of pumpkins, including a pumpkin patch where people can pick their own pumpkin. There are also other things to do, like riding a pony, plunging down a slide, or walking around a corn maze with its confusing winding pathways.
Every year, there's always one or two people that will call our farm market, our office, and say they're lost in the corn maze and they can't get out.
A hayride takes visitors to a large pumpkin patch. Some children discover the big orange fruits weigh more than they think.
I was really happy.
Tristan Piazza plans to carve his pumpkin for Halloween.
I'm going to make the scariest face in the whole neighborhood.
The Butler family owns the 120-hectare farm. Visitors, in season, can pick their own fruits, vegetables, and flowers. Butler's Orchard opened more than 60 years ago as one of the first pick-your-own farms in the area. 89-year-old Shirley Butler and her late husband came up with the idea.
And it's a delight to go out on the farm, which I do a lot, and see the beautiful pumpkins in the field. I have people coming out of the field and thanking me for it, so it makes a fun time for everybody.
Ken Merriam brought his children.
I'm a kid at heart.
He says Butler's Orchard brings back good memories of growing up on a farm in Honduras.
It's a little bit of what I used to have as a kid, so that's why I think it's nice to bring them over here, get them out of the city.
Shirley Butler's grandchildren, who are in their 30s, are now the third generation to run the farm. General Manager Tyler Butler says children who usually only see pumpkins in grocery stores can learn how pumpkins are grown and tell Tyler.
I didn't know pumpkins came from a vine. There's flowers on this vine. There's roots.
These little girls are learning about pumpkins during their first trip to a pumpkin patch.
To feel, you know, the nature and the fruits.
For Tristan Piazza's mother, the fall festival is an annual event.
My parents have always brought me. I bring my kid now. I hope he stays in the area and he can bring his kids.
Since family farms are hard to keep afloat these days, Tyler Butler appreciates the tens of thousands of visitors who come to the fall festival each year. Deborah Block, VOA News, Germantown, Maryland.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion.
Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.